From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in Geneva in February of 2015 when a small project was born. It was supposed to last maybe 2 or 3 months, designed to push the community to think more deeply about how to achieve real equality and access for its citizens. It was called Tools for Social Change. Well, by the end of 2015, it was clear that Tools for Social Change was going to be a rather permanent and growing voice as Geneva grappled with poverty, education, segregation, and more. And now fast forward to February of this year when another local organization was born. This one's called the Geneva Women's Assembly, which was inspired by the USA Women's Strike Platform and Call for Action. And in Geneva, the organizers didn't think that they should have to travel to New York or Chicago to be engaged in radical politics. They were also experiencing, quote, utter frustration with elected leaders, especially Congressman Tom Reed. So Tools for Social Change and the Geneva Women's Assembly are two examples of organizations that have really grown organically. And since this past November, there's been a spike in interest in grassroots movements, political organizing, and the question going forward is whether the interest in communities at that grassroots level will last. The founders of these organizations in Geneva believe it can for various reasons, and they've kind of set a model for involvement. So my guests include Jeremy Waddles, who is a co-founder of Tools for Social Change and the associate director of the Center for Community Engagement and Service Learning at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. Jeremy, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Evan. Glad to be here.
And also here is Hannah Dickinson, a member of the Geneva Women's Assembly and the newly formed Foundry Action Committee. She's an associate professor of writing and rhetoric and the director of the Writing and Enrich Curriculum Program at HWS. Hannah, welcome to the program to you.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
And we are broadcasting from the WEOS studios here in Geneva on Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM. And to all of our 89.5 FM Finger Lakes listeners, it's great privilege to have you listening every day to Connections. We love having the chance to reach far corners of our community, from Rochester to Ithaca, most of the way to Syracuse and Buffalo. We're broadening our reach, and it's great to be here in the studio. This is our first visit to broadcast here, and it will not be the last. We're glad to be here. And let me just ask our guests, first and foremost, just about this involvement. I mean, Jeremy, I do think we're hearing a lot of people say now, you know, no matter their political background, man, I'm what do kids say, woke? I don't know how to use it. I don't know how to use the sentence, but I'm feeling woke. How did I do it?
You did well. Yeah.
Close enough. But they're saying, you know, I want to get involved. And then the question becomes, okay, you're going to go to one march in a year and say you're involved, or are you really going to be involved? Mm-hmm. What are you sort of seeing out there right now?
I think for us, what we're seeing and what we've seen since February of 2015 is that when we take the time to build relationships and really get to know people as human beings from all different walks of life, from some very different political backgrounds, that if we build trust, we can sustain something. And what we want to do is build that trust and then get to work on real issues. So protests are important, but they are only one slice of the pie.
Okay. Hannah, what do you think?
So I think one of the things that the Geneva Women's Assembly has seen is an incredible amount of energy from the Geneva community. It's a vibrant and diverse and active community, and people really want to get the work done. So I think we've had several exciting events where people have said, we're not going to wait for the people in power to make change for us. We can do it here. It's a small enough place. We can actually make our community better.
We've got a chance this hour to kind of dig into what Tools for Social Change and the Geneva Women's Assembly are doing at a local level. And I think as we do that, it will be interesting for no matter where you're listening from today, wherever you're hearing my voice, you can think about organizations in your towns and your communities. And you can ask yourself, you know, do I want to be more involved? How do I do that? Are they actually having an impact? Are they running up against roadblocks? So I think it'll be instructive. And let's start with Tools for Social Change. I kind of gave a brief snapshot of February 2015. But Jeremy, give me more of a look at what was happening and how that came together.
Sure. Well, it came about because I think even before 2015 and the year before in 2014, we were looking at what was happening in Ferguson and Michael Brown and others, and several people in the community and elsewhere were asking, what does this mean for us as a country, and how does this play out here in Geneva? And it's pretty well known that in 2011, there was an unfortunate situation where a unarmed black man was killed by the Geneva police. And so this was a recent wound for many people in the African American community here. And so I talked to some people, and you know, one of the great things about Geneva is it's so service oriented, and we've had, you know, many one-time service projects. We've had our students involved in local churches, And we had built a relationship with one of the pastors here at one of the Black churches, Mount Olive Church. And Reverend Golden, I talked with him and I said, hey, you know, what if we got some community members together and got some students together and started, you know, going a little bit more in depth? You know, I know we've done some work with you in your community garden and we've tried to get to know your congregation a little bit. But what if we went deeper and we really had some conversations and then talked about how these issues play out here in Geneva? And so after Corey Jackson's death, the community and the city, and this is before I was involved, I wasn't really aware of this. I learned about it later on, but the community came together and signed an agreement with the police department and community members and city government. And so we were looking at that and looking at the progress that had been made and what more could be done. And we wanted to sort of intervene there and then look at other issues of access to things in Geneva and opportunity for everybody in Geneva.
When it comes to the mission, and if you've got somebody who bumps you on the street, they've heard about this, but they're not exactly sure, how do you define the mission? What's the short answer for that?
Yeah, I think it's two parts. One is we use dialogue to build trust, as I said earlier, to get to know people and try not to put labels on people, you know, liberal, conservative, whatever it may be, and to really get to know people and build a relationship that can be pushed sometimes if you have disagreements, but you have enough of a strong bond that you can move forward. So we start off with dialogue and getting to know each other and where we all come from. And we sit in a circle. So we're very intentional about this, how we use this space in the church. Everybody sits in a circle. We have democratic decision making. We do have some leadership, but we try not to be super hierarchical. And then from there, we say, all right, here's who we are as Genevans from different backgrounds. And we say, what are the issues that are important to you? Where do you feel included in Geneva? Where do you not feel included in Geneva? How can we work together on that? How can we reach out to city government and business leaders and others, citizens, whatever it might be, to move forward? So it's a two-pronged approach of conversation, building trust, and then taking action on very specific things to try to improve material conditions for everybody.
This is a small thing, but I think it's actually an important small thing. And I didn't even think about this until recently, in a conversation on restorative practices in Rochester schools. When you sit in a circle, no one gets to be the head of it.
Yes.
Everyone is in an equal position.
Yes.
And sometimes just that setup, when it's not a circle, when there's somebody in a position of power talking down to people, can change the way people feel compelled or even available to talk and have their voice heard. So I find that interesting. And you mentioned, you know, politics, left, right, you know, it's not just liberal, conservative. Do you mean to be apolitical? It's not necessarily a political organization, or is it?
That's an ongoing question. I'm not trying to wiggle out of that, honestly.
No,
so we've had hundreds of people that come in and with very different opinions. We had a local election in 2015. There were some hard fought things there. But one of the things we did in 2015 that I think was striving for, especially for nonpartisanship, is that we organized candidates nights and we had every candidate for city government participate, which was great. It was amazing. And we tried to ask, again, specific questions about how we can improve the lives of everybody in Geneva. So what we try to do in Tools, we have people from very different backgrounds and opinions, and some people are very politically active. Other people don't want to be politically active, but they're very passionate about an issue such as access to healthy food, because we have a food desert on the north end of Geneva. So we have very different opinions and a diversity of, I think, intensity of feeling, if you will, mm-hmm. on politics in our group.
But you're not endorsing candidates,
no.
For example? You don't do that?
No.
Okay. And you mentioned that, you know, you have these opportunities for people to have their voice heard, and they can tell you, this is where we're not seeing inclusion. This is where we're having what's an example of an issue that's come up at these conversations with Tools that you can point to say, here's something that we've been able to work on or the work is ongoing?
Yeah, I think that, you know, Geneva has made incredible strides. I used to come here as a little kid. My mom's family goes way back here, and I remember coming here in the 80s, and it was, you know, pretty much a ghost town in certain areas. It's come so far. There are so many great things happening, but one of the key questions is where is the attention going? Is it just going downtown? You know, who's able to speak to our elected officials, and who feels less comfortable speaking? So the north side and where we meet it at Tools, the church is in the 6th ward on the north side. And, you know, people are struggling there economically. I think. And so one of the things that they wanted to address was access to healthy food. We have worked very hard. We've had a subgroup. There are a lot of people here that that couldn't be here today that have done amazing work in the Black community, a lot of women leaders in Geneva, and they've worked on this food justice project. So they've gleaned food from local farmers, produce that would otherwise be thrown away, and they've distributed that to that portion of the community to try to address this need. And I could give other examples, but I don't want to go on too long.
No, yeah. Well, we'll return to some of the ongoing work in a moment here. You're hearing Jeremy Waddles, who is the co-founder of Tools for Social Change here in Geneva. He's also the Associate Director of the Center for Community Engagement and Service Learning at HWS Colleges. And Hannah Dickinson is a member of the Geneva Women's Assembly, among other things. And the Women's Assembly, what's the short definition for what the Women's Assembly is?
So the Geneva Women's Assembly, I should just say from the outset, includes men, includes trans folks. And so really the women part of Women's Assembly is meant to signal our commitment to a feminist politics. And by that, we don't just mean sort of old school women's issues, but we see gender as a thread that runs through justice issues that affect our local community, like environmental justice and environmental racism, as well as an issue that runs through our whole political climate.
And one of the terms that you use in defining the Women's Assembly is intersectional. And that's a sort of a, not, I don't say a hot word on campuses. It's just more of a word that you're hearing as we try to understand challenges people face. And there's some pushback, generally from the right, but not always, on intersectionality. Why is intersectionality important to the Women's Assembly?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tricky word, in part because it comes out of an academic context, right? So it doesn't always map neatly onto community struggles. But for us, it's at least an important concept for getting across the idea that to be organized as feminists doesn't just mean you're only talking about reproductive justice or you're only talking about sexual assault. Those issues are crucial. But if we expand our definition, for example, of what violence against women is, it also includes the violence of low wages. It includes the violence that women in particular experience in ICE detentions. So we're really trying to think about what does it mean to bring a feminist politics that's not just for white women or not just for wealthy women, but a real politics of the 99%.
And Hannah, when it comes to trying to pursue justice on all of these different fronts here, another one of the, I don't know if criticisms, but observation, I go back to the Women's March on January 20th in Washington, and there was a lot of conversation there about whether it was truly inclusive and intersectionality as an issue in that march. But then what kind of came out of that was, well, what are you fighting for? What are you striving for? And the list was long. And one of the things that we hear throughout history is, if you're not more focused, if you're going for everything, then you're not going for anything, that you have to be more focused on one issue at a time or one, two, three issues. How do you respond to the critics who would say, look, the Geneva Women's Assembly has such a broad range of goals that how are you going to organize and focus on any one particular one?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I would say two things. I think one is I actually think issue-focused politics is one of the challenges we have to contend with. We have to figure out how struggles for environmental justice and struggles against predatory policing, what do they have to do with each other? And in Geneva, they happen in the same neighborhood, right? Bad policing is happening in this very same neighborhood where we have lead and arsenic poisoning. So part of it, I think, is actually to see connections and not just think about it as we all have our issues and come together for a march, but really talking about what those links are. But the other thing I would say to answer your question is, we're committed to building community power, right? To saying, hey, the people of Geneva, we should have a say in what our community looks like and what our government does. And so that means we respond to the struggles that are immediate. And so I will say the lead and arsenic poisoning in, again, the north end of Geneva is among the most urgent things facing our community, and that's where we've been dedicating our recent attention.
You might have seen recent articles, starting with Steve Orr in the Democrat and Chronicle and in various places, about the Foundry, and we're going to be talking about that, what environmental justice means, because that's a term you hear. This is a very tangible way to understand exactly what Hannah's talking about. We're going to get into that in just a second, but let me grab our first phone call of the hour. Holden in Rochester is on the line. Go ahead, Holden.
Hey, everybody. How you doing?
Good.
I wanted to ask a question about the tool for social change. In particular, recently there was a podcast on the Chapo Trap House where they had R.L. Stevens on there, and I know he's kind of one of the great organizers. I was wondering in which ways you guys look at organizers like him and how you emulate him. That's my question. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Holden. Go ahead, Jeremy.
Thanks, Holden. So R.L. Stevens, he's a really interesting guy. He's got a law degree, and I recommend he now works doing labor organizing in the Chicago area, and I would definitely check him out if you're interested in that kind of thing. And you know, Geneva is a small town, and we're not at the point where we're trying to do something specific like labor organizing, but I appreciate RL because he's very real about how, you know, things like racial bias and how exclusion happen materially for people on a daily basis. And he's very good at breaking that down, and then he's good at giving suggestions for how people can organize to advocate for themselves. So I think that he's somebody that I've, you know, Tool has been around for going on 2.5 years now, and I've really only been listening to RL for maybe a year. So there's more to learn there. But I appreciate the call.
And let me just piggyback off that with a question for both of you then. More generally, what have you learned about organizing that you can now say, this is, you know, there are certain steps to take and certain steps that might not be all that successful when it comes to organizing? Jeremy?
Sure. I think, again, it's being intentional about listening to people's lived experiences and hearing them out and working from the bottom up. Now, of course, a tension there is when you get too democratic. Like, for example, you look back at Occupy. One of the flaws of Occupy Wall Street was that it was so democratic that everybody got exhausted and very little got done. But it did help change the discourse nationally, and you could argue internationally, with how we think about power relations and organizing. So there are limits to you know, pure horizontal approach, but we really, really try to be intentional about our process and listen to people. And I think that it's not just like you have a one-time event about an issue and somebody presents a nice, slick PowerPoint for 45 minutes and has 10 minutes of questions and everybody sits in rows. That's not inherently bad. I've been to a lot of those. Those can be good. but that's not deep listening, right? That's not really being with people. It's not really hearing who they are and how injustice or exclusion manifests in their lives. And so I hope that's specific enough. But yeah, I think those are some of the things that I've learned.
Okay, Hannah?
A couple things, I guess, about organizing. One of the Geneva Women's Assembly goals, similar to what Jeremy was just talking about, is to make sure that we're making space for working class and poor folks in particular in our organization. And that's hard, right? When people have material conditions that make showing up to meetings difficult, or they're working at night, or childcare is an issue, it's hard for them to get involved in politics. And if on top of that, you've been disenfranchised in a whole host of ways from feeling like politics has anything to do with you, there's that extra barrier. So we've found ourselves getting off Facebook and getting out into the streets, handing out flyers, knocking on doors, especially around the environmental issues, having conversations and helping people feel heard, and then responding directly to those concerns with actual material gains, right? Not just talk, but ways that people can feel like their lives are really improving and they're gaining community power.
Let me be blunt. If you stay on Facebook almost exclusively, do you end up with a lot of white upper class people?
Yeah. I mean, I think certainly we've seen that in Geneva, that we have at least 10% of our population speaks only Spanish, and a whole bunch of folks don't have computers in their homes. So the idea that you could reach folks just through the internet and screens. It doesn't work here.
We're talking to Hannah Dickinson and Jeremy Wattles about their organizing efforts and what they're doing in their community. We're here in Geneva, broadcasting from WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio. Glad to be here today. And if you want to call the program with any comments or questions on organizing, whether you're getting involved at the grassroots level in your community, it's 844-295-TALK. That's toll free, 844-295-8255. Now, Jeremy mentioned, you know, whether tools is apolitical is sort of a debate, but they're not endorsing candidates, et cetera. Hannah has mentioned that there's been some frustration with political leaders. Congressman Reed in particular, yes?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, so, I mean, I think we have some wonderful groups in Geneva and around the Finger Lakes really directly organizing to find candidates to oppose Reed, protesting monthly in front of his office. And that work is incredibly important. I think what we're up to with the GWA is just a little bit different, is saying there's no way that Tom Reed is going to represent intersectional feminist issues, right? That's not what he does. So what do we do to make the lives of women and folks of color in Geneva better under those conditions? So one of the things we did was for our first major action, organized a assembly in front of Tom Reed's office on March 8th for the women's strike, and then occupied the office. And we went in and said, we're not here to rabble rouse. We're here to get the work done that you're not doing. And folks met in small groups and came up with a list of resolutions for what we are already doing in Geneva and what we can continue to do to build community power and say, we don't need Tom Reed to make our lives better. We can do it.
Do you view the Women's Assembly as a political organization?
You know, it's a complicated question. I think we're not engaged in, I would say, mainstream politics in any long-term way. So the places in which we engage in mainstream politics are when it's going to help the people that we're working with get the things they need. So for example, we've seen our city council move really slowly to address the lead and arsenic poisoning affecting hundreds and hundreds of Genevan families. And so, right, that's a site where showing up to speak at city council and protest at city council, have those conversations with our council members, that's really important. But for other struggles, engaging in mainstream politics may not be the most important move.
I also think it's probably important to distinguish, Hannah, between a question of whether an organization is political versus whether it is partisan, right? I mean, partisanship is one thing, but sometimes you have to engage with politics if you want outcomes.
Yeah, and I think that's a really helpful response, because yes, I am happy to claim that GWA is a political organization in the sense that we're aiming to make political and social change. But yeah, the question of who's a Democrat, who's a Republican, who's a socialist, like that's not what we're talking about.
All right, we're going to get our only break of the hour, and when we come back, I want to dive into the foundry issue that again you might have seen in various forms of media, but wait until you hear exactly. I mean, It really reads like an environmental justice horror story.
Pretty bad.
And to the extent that we hear that term, environmental justice, what does it mean? I'm going to read, when we come back, a section of a story that Steve Orr wrote in the Democratic Chronicle that just kind of stopped me in my tracks. And then Hannah's going to help us understand what local organizations are doing about that. So let's get our only break of the hour and come right back with you on Connections from WEOS. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, we're talking to leaders of local settlement houses. And sometimes you hear the terms, the Baden Street, for example, these kinds of organizations, but do you know what settlement houses are? Do you know what they actually do on a day-to-day basis for our community? Who they support? How they were founded? It's a deep dive into settlement houses, Monday on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and we're talking about organizing at the local level with Jeremy Wattles, who is the co-founder of Tools for Social Change in Geneva, and Hannah Dickinson, who is a member of the Geneva Women's Assembly and the newly formed Foundry Action Committee. And we talk about the Foundry. First, very quickly, Hannah, you know, I'm going to talk about, I'll kind of get set us up for what's been going on for years, but what was the Foundry?
So the Foundry is a factory that made iron stoves and other objects, and so The smoke from that foundry emits an ash with toxic metals in it, especially lead and arsenic. And so while that factory closed in the late 80s, we're still living with the environmental repercussions of that smokestack.
Here's a story from Steve Orr in the Democrat and Chronicle this past November, and I'll read now. Quote, 30 years ago, New York State officials first uncovered evidence that toxic metals from an old foundry in the historic Finger Lakes city of Geneva had contaminated an adjoining neighborhood. A state environmental health expert concluded then, in 1987, that people were at risk of lead poisoning, and neighbors should be warned. Young children, those prone to placing fingers, other objects, or dirt in their mouths, are of particular concern, the expert, Dr. John Hawley, wrote in an internal memo in June of 1987. The consultants recommended that the lead-laden soil in yards be removed. But state and city officials never warned residents, and the decision to clean it up was deferred 16 more years, a Democrat and Chronicle investigation found. Children dug for worms and played in the dirt, and adults planted gardens for more than a generation, oblivious to the real risk posed by that tainted soil. The silence ended only in early October of last year when state environmental officials mailed letters to nearly 100 properties near the former Geneva foundry site, informing the owners their soil contained lead or arsenic in concentrations that are considered unsafe. The threat is significant enough, officials told startled neighborhood residents, that the state will spend $17 million to dig up the bad soil and cart it away. They did not, however, tell residents that they'd known about the contamination for 30 years. End quote. Remarkable. Just a remarkable story. Is this a perfect example, Hannah, of when we talk about environmental justice, is this it?
It is. I mean, and the neighborhood that you're talking about is the neighborhood that immigrants historically moved into when they moved into Geneva. So generations ago, that was an Italian neighborhood with folks growing, you know, huge gardens. And but now it's predominantly African-American and Latino with many, many Spanish speakers, lots of families. And so while, yeah, it's economically mixed, it is certainly among the poorest neighborhoods in Geneva. So you can start to see how issues around gender and family, issues around health, issues around race, issues around migration, right, are sort of all coming together in this one example where, you know, I don't want to be alarmist about it, but this is not a group of folks that has historically been politically engaged in Geneva. And so, yeah, some sense that our city council somehow thought they could get past this without folks fighting back. But they are.
And so there's a Foundry Action Committee now. But, you know, some might wonder, well, wait, didn't Steve Orr's story say that the state's going to spend $17 million to dig up the bad soil and cart it away? What else do we want them to do?
Yeah, so the Foundry Action Committee, which is a group of residents of the Foundry Zone, as well as supporters from around Geneva, have put together a sort of vision of justice that I would say has sort of three tacks. So one is to insist that the cleanup be transparent and much more speedy than what's planned. This summer we'll only see 15 houses remediated, and this is as they're doing more testing to potentially expand the zone. We're looking at this cleanup taking up to 10 years, right? So that's 10 years of a kid's childhood not being able to play in their own yard. So part of this is pushing the DEC to get the cleanup done faster and pushing the city not to prioritize development projects before they clean up folks' homes. But folks are also calling for life to be livable in the Foundry Zone while we wait for cleanup. So if it's not safe to garden in your neighborhood, and, you know, we have folks growing just gallons and gallons of material for salsa, tomatillos, things that they can't buy at the grocery store. They're too expensive. So folks are calling for support in building raised bed gardens or transportation to safe, supervised places for their children to play. But finally, residents are also calling for an investigation. People want to know what the city of Geneva knew, what the state of New York knew, when they knew it, and why we weren't told.
Who made those decisions?
Yeah.
Do we have a sense of any of those answers yet?
You know, it's pretty tricky. The city's been really quiet on this, partly because there are some ongoing lawsuits. So the Geneva Women's Assembly, in support of the Foundry Action Committee, has gone through hundreds and hundreds of FOIA documents and tried to put together a kind of story. So but we're not there yet. Rather than sort of jumping to conclusions, yeah, we would like a transparent and fair investigation, because we want to make sure this doesn't happen again. This is undoubtedly not the last environmental issue that Geneva will face. And we now have residents who know a whole lot about their community and how environmental justice and racism impacts them. And they should have a voice in making sure that our city is safe from these environmental risks moving forward.
If this contamination had happened in a wealthy neighborhood, would it have been handled differently?
I'm certain. Yeah, and, you know, it's the DEC sort of drew a boundary line based on their testing of sort of who is in the zone and who is outside of the zone in ways that I think feel deeply arbitrary to Genevans, but run the risk of being really divisive. So I think we need in Geneva to be thinking about how do we act like neighbors? How do we take care of our neighbors? How do we understand that in a city of 13,000 people, it's not okay to have one neighborhood bounded off by arbitrary boundary lines that will suffer while the rest of us get to be fine?
Before I grab our next phone call, I will just remind listeners that it wasn't that long ago we welcomed Aaron Mayer, who is the head of the Sierra Club, the first African-American president of the Sierra Club, who told the story when he was raising a family in the Albany area in a poorer neighborhood and learned that there was what looked like ash just settling on cars and plants and streets in the air. And it was trash burning that was essentially illegal, but certainly toxic and dangerous. But guess what was downwind? Well, a poorer area. And so did anybody do anything for a while? No. If this was happening in Pittsford, New York, or wealthy areas, are they going to do something? Absolutely, yes. And so that's why I asked Hannah. I mean, it was a bit of a softball, but yes, yes. I mean, we have a history of understanding that when poorer communities are impacted negatively in environmental ways, there's not the prioritization of resources, of response, of information. That's just what happens. And when we talk about climate justice, Hannah, I imagine it's the same kind of thing, that climate justice involves making sure people are protected from what happens on coastal areas in various communities. But when it comes to who is not as protected or not prioritized, it's generally people in more impoverished areas, yes?
That's correct. And we can see the ways that these issues start to intersect, right? So because poor areas don't have the same voice in civic in the government, right? Issues are getting ignored because there are myths about, which is not true in Geneva, but about folks not paying taxes, right? Somehow that means that they're not contributing as much as wealthy folks, which is, I don't know, frankly, sort of a disgusting way to think about one's neighbors. But it also is clearly we know it's the case with lead poisoning that having a diet of healthy fruits and vegetables rich in iron and calcium helps keep lead from settling into children's bones. So if we're talking about a part of Geneva where there's a food desert, that also has impacts on the degree to which the lead and arsenic poisoning are affecting people.
Jeremy, do you see that overlap?
Definitely. You know, back in the day, the north end of the city used to be called the butt end. And there's also, again, Geneva, and I want to be clear, like, there are great things happening in Geneva. I feel positive about the future. There are folks in city government who do want to make things better and tools, and I think GWA is working with them, even though we may not agree on every single thing. But I think we have to just be able to hold the good things that are happening in Geneva equal with some of the injustice. And, you know, Geneva's been called the ghetto of the Finger Lakes, and the north end of Geneva's been called the butt end. And I just think that we've got to be honest about this and understand that there are inequities there. You know, I just became a father a year ago. My wife and I are going to buy a house soon. And that changes so much. You know, before you're a parent, you're like, oh, well, that's terrible what happened in Flint, Michigan. And then you become a parent and you think about these things. You think about how it can affect your child who needs care from you all the time in order to survive. And we have to work with the city, even if it's difficult, even if we don't always agree, but we have to pull together and figure this out. And I think it needs to be done faster.
All right, let me get a phone call in Rochester. This is Jane on the line. Go ahead, Jane.
Hi, Evan. You really stole my thunder here. I was going to talk a little bit about how often it's said that the poor don't vote. And any group of people that is viewed as, well, what difference will it make? They won't say anything. They don't have any means of holding us accountable. I think, unfortunately, can invite indifference from the powers that be. And it's also been said often, and I love this little cliche about the squeaky wheel gets the oil. And poor people or other classes, groups, if you're ever viewed as being powerless or passive, it helps to learn how to squeak loudly. But I agree that the affluent areas of that wouldn't tolerate what some of the less affluent areas tolerate for whatever reason. So the solution to mitigate some of this class double standard of attention is voting as a first step, if nothing else. Vote, 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 vote. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jane. Appreciate the phone call. Hannah, what do you think?
Well, of course, voting is really important, and I'm glad that Jeremy mentioned some of our really wonderful city officials. Mark Gramling, a councilor at large for Geneva in particular, has been a real leader on this lead issue. He lives just across the street from the foundry and has done an incredible job of amplifying the voices of his neighbors. And that wouldn't have happened, right, had people not come out and voted. He's our first African-American city council member. Highest vote getter. I mean, so there are exciting things that voting can accomplish. But I will also say, we've been really amazed with the Foundry Action Committee about what other kinds of political engagement can accomplish too, right? Showing up at city council with 20 people prepared to talk about how lead and arsenic poison is deeply impacting their lives, the health of their children, a sense of feeling really trapped, right? What happens if now that I don't think I can sell this house, right? Am I stuck in this poisoned environment for the rest of my children's life, for the rest of my life, right? And so that kind of speaking out too, it was really amazing, right? Just 20 folks were able to push back against some of the moves our city council was making to sweep this under the rug.
I can just add into
that. Yeah, go ahead.
Add that briefly. The last local elections were in 2015, and the turnout was up from 2011, but it was still below 40%. And so, again, trending in the right direction, but, and that war, the North End, again, the turnout is low. And I don't mean that to blame the people on the North End. I think it's, again, like there are real issues of trust here and of being able to speak to what's happening with their environment and with their opportunities. And so, we try to be apolitical as much as we can, and we want to work on voter registration and voter education. So you were talking about organizing earlier, and I think one of the things that we need to do more of, and I think we could team up with Geneva Women's Assembly and do some work together, is just knocking on doors having bilingual speakers with us, Spanish speakers with us, and doing the registration and talking about the issues that way also, because we need to make sure everybody's voice is heard. I mean, Mark Gramling's amazing, and I know him well, and I love him, but it's kind of shocking that it took that long for a black person to be elected in the city with such a strong and vibrant black community.
All right, on Twitter, Joseph wants to know, can your guests address the geographic dimension here? How to bring rural and urban citizens together across boundaries? What are the issues there? I'll start with you, Hannah.
Such a great question, because it's something that GWA has been thinking about a lot. I have some organizing experience in larger cities, and there you're often contending with, other longstanding groups, other activists. There's some turf stuff that can happen. And one of the most exciting things about organizing in Geneva is that's not what happens, right? No matter what organization you're a part of, people are so deeply committed to making this a better place lots of that kind of, political infighting is totally avoided. And I've been amazed at the kind of speedy progress of GWA's initiatives, the incredible work that Tools for Social Change has done. So I think that's one really exciting part about organizing in small towns and cities. And so connecting with folks in large cities is important, for sure, but I think it could go both ways, right? Recognizing that we have talented organizers and vibrant, committed communities, and big cities have something to learn from what's going on here too.
Jeremy?
I think the scale of Geneva is really remarkable because we have diverse demographics, and we have, you know, as we sometimes say, urban characteristics. We could parse that another day, maybe. but we are in a rural area, in an agricultural area, in this natural setting with the beautiful lake. So I think that we were this sort of weird and wonderful amalgamation of all of that. And yes, I think that we can learn from what's going on in Rochester. We've had a couple of speakers come down from Rochester and talk about some of their community work, and I'd love to learn more about that. But I think that and I'm not saying this to pat myself on the back, like there are literally hundreds of people that have been involved with tools I have learned so much from, because I grew up in the North Syracuse suburbs, which were, you know, there were great things about it, but it was very sheltered and very, very white. And so I have learned so much coming to Geneva, and I think that people can learn from us too.
Let me ask both of you, how many people are getting involved in your organizations and how many people are staying involved? You mentioned hundreds of people getting involved, but how many are kind of turning up once and then not again? This goes back to some of those conversations we had in January with people who said, okay, I attended a march for the first time in my life. But, you know, the question after that was, is that it? Or are you going to be involved? And are you going to march once a year? Or are you going to get involved and stay involved? Jeremy, when it comes to Tools for Social Change, how many people have been involved and how many people are consistently involved?
It ebbs and flows. I think, again, around the last election cycle, we had well over 100 people, and not every night and not on every Tuesday night, but, you know, over the course of a month, we would well over 100 people or more coming through. And, you know, we're all volunteer. And we all have lives and we all have jobs as well. So it ebbs and flows. Right now, I think we're kind of coming out of a little bit of a dip, and we're looking at some exciting work with the city on economic opportunity and poverty alleviation. So I think we're going to push our numbers back up. Right now, it's between 10 and 20 people every week. But that's every single week we have people there. I mean, we're not going to meet in like the 4th of July, for example, but it's like we're there 48 weeks out of the year, and there are always people there. And that's impressive to me. I haven't seen that kind of grassroots energy before. And I think it also resonates with some of what's going on with the national scene.
I was going to ask you, I mean, your organization's 2.5 years old now, but do you sense a spike in interest post-November?
Absolutely. We had people come in that hadn't come in before. We had people who hadn't been in a while. And they were really trying to process and in some cases just understand and learn more, but in some cases just grieve. They were scared. People were scared. And again, whatever your feelings about the national political scene right now, it's undeniable that there were some very ugly things that came out during the campaign. And we're in a difficult time in terms of how we think about the public good. In terms of how we think about taking care of each other as human beings. And so I think people really, really felt that. And I felt it in a way I hadn't before, because we've seen, and you're seeing it now, like you're seeing a spike in hate crimes nationally. You're seeing people in those Rochester suburbs who are getting flyers in their mailboxes about make Pittsburgh great again, make fill in the blank white again. And, you know, as a person who's married to a woman of color, I was just scared in a way that I hadn't been before. But I imagine that some people of color have felt their whole life. And that was profound for me to try to figure out and learn from and work through. Anyway, I'll stop there.
How about the GWA in terms of involvement and continual involvement?
Yeah, so we have about 10 committed organizers, and it feels important to say from sort of all different parts of life, right? So we have waitresses and professors and folks who work in wineries. So 10 committed organizers and putting in lots and lots of hours every week. And then a sort of broader assembly of 50 or 60 folks who are on our mailing list, who come to our events. And then for big actions, we've seen really great success. So for the March 8th strike, we had, between 300 and 400 people outside Tom Reed's office giving speeches and sharing their ideas with one another. So I think to build on what Jeremy is saying, it suggests something about the level of engagement and enthusiasm from Genevans to be involved in organizing and activist work, and suggests that, yeah, people want to get out of their homes. They want to get out from behind their screens. They want to be working with their community to make it better.
I want to get both of your take on something that Damon Linker wrote in The Week recently. Last month, he wrote a piece called The Foolish Complacency of Optimistic Liberals. The idea was this. Most of us are familiar with the idea that, you know, progress is this continual upward movement, and that occasionally there are steps back. But throughout history, you know, humanity, especially in this country, has been on this march toward progress, and we will continue to go forward even if we take steps back. In terms of voting rights, in terms of real equality, in terms of extending that. Damon Linker says that complacency is dangerous. Here's what he writes. He says, too many liberals assume that that this reaction, that progress is ever moving upward, is shared by everyone, if only the facts are presented to them, that they can change their mind. And this assumption is false. It's an outgrowth of the deeply rooted liberal belief in progress. Most liberals really do believe, sometimes deep down but often right on the surface, that they are bound to prevail, inevitably, in the fullness of time, and quite likely very soon, just around the corner, despite minor setbacks like the election of Donald Trump. They are wrong. And Linker goes on to say, that complacency is a good way to stop progress. That you are, if you're going to just assume and sit back and say, well, there's going to be ebbs and flows and ups and downs, but eventually we move upward, that we're not guaranteed to continue to see progress, that there has to be real intention and effort. Hannah, what do you think?
So a couple thoughts. I mean, I think, one, the critique of liberals being interested in incremental change as the way to make things better, I think, is a fair critique, right? We're in a moment in which small strides, that's not enough, right? We can't wait patiently for the DEC to clean up the Foundry neighborhood for 10 years. That's too slow, right? So I think in that way, I think we need a politics, and I think we're starting to see it, that says, we don't have to take scraps. We can demand justice, and we can get it. I think in that way, those are helpful comments. The other thing I guess I would just say is, I think optimism is important, right? The alternative right now is barbarism, right? I mean, it's the kind of world that Jeremy was just talking about, where people are afraid to leave their homes, they're afraid to speak to their neighbors, where whole parts of our population are being targeted. The crisis is real, but that doesn't suggest defeatism to me. That means staying committed to that, the optimistic struggle, right? Continuing to do the work to make change that might actually be really big.
Jeremy?
Yeah, I'm going to go, well, where to start with that? That was a great excerpt. Thank you. I'm going to go back to some of my training, my literature training. One of my favorite authors is Milan Kundera, and it's either in The Book of Laughter and Forgetting or The Unbearable Lightness of Being, where he talks about this myth of the march of progress. I wonder if Damon got it from the author there. But yes, absolutely. This is at best a pendulum. Like, it is not a linear thing, and we have to fight for it every day. And I think that it's vital that we have that optimism, but we temper it with knowing that when we get up in the morning, that these things aren't guaranteed, that we always have to fight for justice for each other. And we're also living in a context right now where we're seeing increasing economic inequality that is not abating. It keeps going and grinding people and really, really hurting people. And yes, I think the point about incrementalism and that critique is definitely well taken. You look at what the British election last night, and even in the Labour Party, everybody was saying, oh, Corbyn's going to be a disaster. He went out and he spoke to people about their lived reality and made simple, clear arguments how you can make society better. Now, I'm not saying you have to be a socialist like Jeremy Corbyn, but the current model we have is not working globally, and it manifests itself in some ways locally. And so how can we think about that and work for everybody to do better.
Are you also an optimist?
Well, my father's a minister, so, you know, a Presbyterian minister, so I was raised to believe in original sin. But yeah, I'm convicted by optimism, but, you know, I have my dark moments, yeah.
All right, so we got about a minute left here. Jeremy Waddles, tell people how to get involved with Tools for Social Change and you know, what you want them to know going forward.
Yeah, thank you. We meet Tuesday nights at Mount Olive Church in the north side on Clark Street. It's open to anybody who wishes to come. We have occasionally we have potluck, usually it's pizza. And you can also we have a Facebook group where we are working on becoming a nonprofit and getting like a formal web page and an email. So kind of stay tuned on that. Again, we're all volunteers and we're trying to get ourselves to a more organized place.
Okay, that's Tools for Social Change, the Geneva Women's Assembly and the Foundry Action Committee. Hannah?
Yeah, so the best way to get in touch with the Geneva Women's Assembly is through our Facebook page or through email. We're genevansforjustice@gmail.com. And the Foundry Action Committee does have meetings welcome to folks outside of the Foundry Zone and outside of Geneva, and we meet the first and third Thursday of the month at St. Peter's Church on 151 Genesee.
You need allies that are outside the zone,
right,
don't you?
We do.
Allyship is an important term these days and what it means, and I know they're thinking a lot about that. Hannah Dickinson, a member of the Geneva Women's Assembly and the newly formed Foundry Action Committee, an associate professor of writing and rhetoric and the director of the Writing and Enriched Curriculum Program at Hobart and William Smith Colleges. Nice having you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
And Jeremy Waddles is a co-founder of Tools for Social Change and associate director of the Center for Community Engagement and Service Learning at HWS Colleges. Nice having you as well.
Thank you so much.
And we really appreciated our time. Our thanks to Greg Cotterill right here. Hi, Greg. It's great to see you in person here. He does such great work for us at Finger Lakes Public Radio and gets so little credit. Kelly Walker, Greg Cotterill, the great crew here. Megan Mack, producer. Rob Braden running the engineering board back at WXXI. That's what it is. And I'm just Evan Dawson. We had a great time at WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio. And wherever you're listening, have a great weekend. We'll talk to you Monday.